Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Spoken Heard, a forum for spoken word artists in the North American continent. I'm filling in for the usual host, Susan Dobie Chase. I'm Rick McIntyre, here with our guest today, Mark Skripchak. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, welcome. And why don't we just kick the show off with a poem?
Okay. This poem's called Questions of Being Left Alone While on Tinder. I haven't met my partner. I often wonder what her name is. Have we met before? Will she be chasing me, or will I have to be the one doing the chasing? Does she believe in love at first sight, or waiting for that right moment to connect? Is it a series of coincidences like in How I Met Your Mother? Is she anything like my mother? Will she be strong-willed? Is she emotionally honest? Will she not want to be called baby? Will she be a feminist? Will she mind me wanting to be a stay-at-home dad? Will she admit that I'm a better cook than her? Am I just like her father? Will she say things just to please me? Will she let me have my man cave? Does she like poetry more than the idea of poets? Can she sit through 9 innings and not be bored? Will I be more than a trophy? Can she handle my baggage? Will she accept my brother and his autism? Will she be able to handle the vibrations he brings to the air? Will she allow me to speak freely about him? Will she want me to love him too? Does she know anyone I know? Do I know anyone she knows? Wonder what her favorite book is. Can she appreciate a good beer? Will she teach me how to dance? Will she mind that I'm a textbook Capricorn? Will she mind doing things than just being with me? Does she mind solitude? Will it bother her that my future is up in the air? Where am I going? Where might I live? Where am I going to work? What does the road have for me? Can she keep up with me when I can't sit down? Can she compete with my love for things and concepts? Can she steal my attention? Will she blow my mind and make me feel stupid? Can she do the impossible and make me want to fall in love with her?
Wow. So, first off, I have to say, get out of my head and stop writing my life. Secondly, I really love how that poem shifts back and forth between, like, you know, the real world and sort of the interior monologue. You're welcome.
It was just
welcome.
Like a stream of conscious, like, you know, writing that I did, and then I was like, you know what, this has a lot of fluidity to it.
Yeah, it's hard to pull off poems that are nothing more than questions, and that one really does. You know, it the flow keeps you from, getting bogged down. I'm trying to remember particular moments. The vibrations he brings to the air was a particularly stunning image.
Yeah, my brother's... I'm sorry.
No, go on.
My brother's autistic, and I mean, it encompasses a lot of my life and a lot of my recent writing, and it's like those, like, the little things that, like, I can talk about it, but, like, not many people get to experience being around my brother. So, like, I like to bring, like, that aspect of my life in my writing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So in your bio, and we talked a little bit about this pre-show, you've recently been kind of focusing on coaching.
Yeah.
You know, in the slam world, I should follow that up, not just, you know, coaching.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of coaching. It's one of those experiences, like, you get to not mold people, but you get to see people's, like, potential grow, and you give them some direction on how to get that potential to come out. And one thing that I always feel that, like, when you're in the slam community and you're in, like, a major slam, whether it be, like, nationals or Cup C, you're put in a situation where the best way I can describe it is that you're given someone else's Maserati and your whole goal is not to crash the car. It's putting a lot of faith in you to, you know, to shine. Because, I mean, they're, like, they're
right.
Trusting you, like, are you picking the right poem for me to go up and do, whether it's, like, you know, strategically to win or is it the best way to showcase my work. And it's, like, a big responsibility as a coach is realizing, all right, do I want to win or do I want to showcase this person to a larger audience? And that's always, like, the hardest thing to figure out what to do.
Yeah, I mean, we all are there at the Nationals to compete, so the idea of winning and wanting to win and whatever gorgeous cash prizes are involved in that. You know, and also, I mean, I'm making a joke, but also you get a lot of PR and exposure, and college gigs can come from that sort of thing. On the other hand, I agree that there's a marked difference sometimes in the teams that are clearly going there to win and have almost, well, not almost, in a lot of cases, reduced slam down to, you know, binary digits, you know, versus, you know, the idea of going there and reading the poem you want to do in front of, you know, audience X.
Yeah, like, I remember the second year I did Cup C, our team, I was coaching Rutgers, and our team didn't do well in the standings, but the second bout, I decided to be like, all right, I want to make a statement, I want the most important poets and poems to go up, and it ended up leading us to have two poems that went viral. And that was, like, a bigger victory than actually, like, you know, coming in, like, the top 10 or the top 20. It was just that the idea that we picked two poems. One of them was called Rape Poem to End All Rape Poems. And the other one was by Justice Hare called Not Buying It, about, like, the commercialization of breast cancer. And it was, like, bringing those poems to, like, a larger audience. At that moment, it was like, okay, we're performing for a couple hundred people, and then they ended up, like, reaching, like, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. So that's a pretty, like, amazing thing, that it's, like, a bigger victory than actually winning the slam.
That's wonderful. And the first poem was written by?
It was a group piece.
Oh, group piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then those poems are accessible on YouTube, I'm going to.
Yes. Yeah,
sweet.
The channel's Lindsay Michelle Williams. She was on the team and she filmed a good portion of Cup C that year. So it's worth checking out.
Nice. Well, for those of you listening, there's some juicy bits of YouTube you can get in between the Funny Cats and Christopher Walken bits. Or maybe I'm just talking about me there. Cool. So a little bit more about coaching, because you're putting other people's poems and exposure, you know, above your own.
Mm-hmm.
Like the there's no, you know, spotlight that catches the coaching. There's no coaching competition event, so to speak.
No, not at all.
That'd be great.
It's It's something like when you realize when you get to a point as a slammer, where I mean I've competed at nationals. I was when the Haiku national head to head was 3 days. I was on the final stage there, and then I did competed in like numerous regionals and stuff like that. You start realizing that I got the hunger. I got it out of my system of, you know, my individual, like, victories. And when it came to coaching, it became more about giving other people this exposure, letting them shine. I was approached about coaching because, like, the Rutgers needed a coach, and I said, if you ever need help, let me know. And they tell me like 2 weeks before they go to set up the and I'm just like giving them a crash course on slamming and holding the microphone and all this, you know, little stuff. But I mean, it was just seeing how much they grew in that short period of time. And then when I got to work with them again, and then in Jersey City, there's a poet, Rashad Wright, who I really think is like he's going to be the torchbearer of the Jersey City poetry community. Just seeing how much he's grown in the last like 2 years after coaching him is just that, like, he has that hunger, and he's somebody that will probably take it beyond because he leads by example, as opposed to just me just like allowing people to have the stage. Like, he's somebody that is a future coach because he helped me co-coach this last team. Like, he's gonna lead by example, and that's also really important as well as being a coach.
Yeah, that's gotta be. Well, it's really gotta feed the spirit, you know, when you're in service to somebody else's voice and really watch it develop. I know, not really been in a coaching capacity, but as a team member, it never gets old watching the one person on the team for whom it is their first national, you know, and just watching their minds get blown.
Yeah. Like, I mean, even like this past year, we had a poet that was on our team's name was Theron Jenkins. And he was Loser Slam's Grand Slam champ a couple years ago. And he took a break and he made our team, and he was like, I got nothing new. And he was like in a rut, and he was trying to write this one poem, and it took so long. And there was moments where like, this poem better be the poem to end all poems, you know, like, cause it was just one of those, like, he was taking his time, and he was painstakingly like making decisions and asking for people's advice. And he wasn't sure if it was any good. And it was just before we left, he had it ready to go. And, you know, again, it was like a position where it's like, you want to win, or, you know, you're trying to showcase people. And it was the second night, and we were pretty much out of it. Our position was to take the three in the slam and a 4x4. People are not really familiar with how slam works. And he went up there, and like he like poured everything into it, and he got a 30, and it was just like that was winning nationals. I was running up around the back of the room like I won the slam, seeing him pull that off, and it was just a beautiful moment.
That is cool. So, but now, currently, along with coaching, you are the, I guess, Slam Master is the term we're trying to change, Slam Coordinator of JC Slam.
Yeah. I mean, I've been, like, on my resume, I've turned it into, like, event coordinator, event facilitator, to, you know,
right,
make it seem, like, more accessible to people that aren't into Slam.
Right. So cool. Well, we're about at halfway point, so I was wondering if you could do us another poem.
Sure. Let's get ready here. This poem is called Seven Things I Never Told My Older Autistic Brother Because I Know Better, in reverse chronological order, after Mindy Netafee. Seven. It's forgiveness and emotion that you can express. Allowing myself to be this honest makes me fear that you can't. Six, in therapy, I was asked if my life would be different if you died. I said no. I can't stomach our parents' grief. I stopped going. Five, there's a chance my children will be autistic. I don't need to be shamed to do the right things. I just have concerns of placing that burden on their mother. Four, I still don't know how to talk about you. When people find out that I have a brother, they want to know so much, but they don't want to know how difficult it was for me. Three, I blamed you for being left back in the first grade. I don't tell anyone this. Instead, I make up stories about you in school. They make more sense than telling the truth. Two, on my fifth birthday, you broke my Masters of the Universe walkie-talkies when I wanted to play with you. I haven't gotten over that we aren't meant to talk. One, I can't remember the last time I said I love you. There's no way for me to know if you tried saying the same to me. Thank you.
And boom, there it is. Wow, that is a devastatingly honest poem. I mean,
yeah, it's the hardest one I ever had to write.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. I think a writing prompt I got from Tony Brown once was to write a poem in which you are not the hero. You know, and not only are you not the hero, but you own up to the darker side of being human. Because we all have it, just a lot of poets try to seem like they're better than that. You know, I'm social justice warrior all the time. Yeah, no, not really.
I remember like when I first read that in Mindy's book, her version was about talking about her sister. I mean, it was like, mind you, it was a much different context of how I wrote it in. Was that, she admitted things like hooking up with like her past, you know, her sister's partner, and like, you know, stealing stuff from her room. And I mean, like, this is stuff that she wasn't willing to say to her face, even though it was like some of it would be easily forgiven.
Right.
And when I was looking at it, where it was like, my brother is a very low functioning autistic man, and like, he will never know any of this. And it's like, sometimes I feel like me being, you know, a brother of an autistic person, you get caught up in the idea of always like saying and doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, oh, I'm an activist and I support Autism Speaks and I, you know, and I, you know, I donate stuff to group homes and all that type of stuff. But I mean, what it comes down to it, like, you come home to like a lot of like confused like emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then people don't see those confused emotions. Like I always felt that like there was never somebody that was an autism activist that spoke to me. You know, they always talk about like love and understanding, but like love and understanding is kind of like sitting there like, okay, my brother just took my food off my plate and started eating it. Or, you know, my brother makes, you know, weird ticking sounds, or, you know, or he makes the whole family uncomfortable at the holidays. It's like, there's like little things that like the people just don't experience. They only see like, you know, high functioning or just kind of like I'm the hero. I'm here to help these people. And it's like, it's not
right.
Like being in the trenches.
Yeah, well, definitely in the popular media, you know, they always want to present the higher functioning autism. It makes, you know, the better, easier story. I have
I mean, some of those stories are beautiful. I mean, there's no, you know, no talking down on that.
No, not at all.
But it's not mine.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people are telling your story. I know, you know, one of my children has or had Asperger's, which, you know, I'm being told now is no longer a thing. They're phasing that thing that he was diagnosed for, you know, almost decades with, and now it's just called high functioning.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, my child, I certainly love him. It wasn't the easy, you know, the easiest parenting I've ever done.
No.
But, anyway,
you're still learning.
You. This is true. Back to you. So, after having spent some time focusing on coaching and organizing, you mentioned you're getting back into writing.
Yeah, the first poem I did.
Tell us everything about that.
Yeah, the first poem I did is from a series of poems that I'm writing about being 30 and single, and I was actually inspired by Rachel Wiley's book called The Young Unmarried, which is about her
mm-hmm.
experience being 30 and single, and
mm-hmm.
and like a lot of it was like, you know, that was just me like asking questions of what my, you know, my future lover may be. But I mean, I've started writing about like past lovers, and the odd thing about that is like I don't want to name them by name, and
mm-hmm.
it's like I'm writing about them, and I've been going to open mics, and I've been like, you know, editing their names, and I've been coming up with the most generic names possible because their actual names are better than anything I can come up with off the top of my head. Like I was like I'm doing like a potluck, like, you know, house reading, and I'm like, yeah, and this poem's called For Sally.
For Sally, awesome. Yeah, well, it's hard, you know, poets have such awesome names or come up with awesome names that, you know, you can't just say, oh, I'm writing a poem about one of those people named, you know, fill in names.
Yeah. But still, I mean, it's just the idea that, like, that's making up, like, the most generic name to get your story across.
Uh-huh. Yeah, trust me, the single in your 30 poems is something I survived. I'm actually now writing single in my 50s poems, but, you know. So there's some universal truth in that, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So when you talked earlier about concept chapbooks, I found that kind of interesting. So you're writing, is this because you're writing a number of series of poems or you're writing around, you know, strong central concept?
It's a mixture of the two. When I was coaching, like the one thing that I was preaching was like, I had, you know, Rutgers, it was a, you know, a very strong, feminist scene. And I was like, I don't care if we're going to throw up like 12 feminist poems. I mean, that, if that's our strength and that's what you want to talk about, that's what we're going to do. And I was even talking with some of the people in Jersey City where it was like, you know, our co-slam master, Anne-Marie Manso, always writes about her past abuse with this one ex-lover of hers. And it was like, if you need to write that poem like 10 times, you do it. And I started noticing that, like, I was practicing what I was preaching. Where mm-hmm. I wanted to write about like relationships. I write about my brother. And then recently I've been writing about being a Polish American and how like I have like a disconnect from being Polish at times because my family came here like before World War I. So I don't have outside of food and some little like customs. Like meeting Polish people is like always like they're like, well, you're not Polish, and I'm like, yes, I am. And but I mean, I've noticed that there's like some people that I've met that were just either, you know, like second, third generation, like, you know, really like understanding a lot of what I was having in conversation. And I wrote a poem that was at Nationals about, you know, it was about the Caton Massacre, and I related it to the death of my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
You just Wikipedia Caton Massacre. It's a really horrible thing that happened during World War II. It was a genocide of a bunch of Polish leaders by the hands of the Russians.
Yeah, actually, I'm familiar with the incident.
But
I'm kind of related,
like my disconnect was like, you know, this big gap because, you know, there's the death of culture and then there was the death of my grandmother.
Right.
And it's something that I've been exploring. I mean, like a lot of it I've been writing about like food or my awkward like moments of like, hey, you're Polish and you don't speak the language. I actually had one friend that she actually said that I'm 50% Polish. She said I was a quarter Polish because I didn't speak the language. And I was like, wow. So,
no.
I mean, yeah, it's
yeah.
a little bit of a jab, but I mean, like, she is saying some truth to it, too.
Sure. I guess one question is, you know, do you find yourself, you know, coming up with the concept first and writing poems around it? Or is it you looked at your body of work and said, wow, I have a whole bunch of poems that are around this theme?
That's kind of where it was like I was noticing a trend, or I was noticing like I would like take note, like, you know, I'm one of those poets that like writes in bullet points for ideas and to like
mm-hmm.
come up with poems. And I was just noticing that there was like a similar theme of like, okay, failed relationships, my brother being a Polak, and then there might be an occasional like, you know, some other issue that would come up. That would be more of like a spur of the moment thing, but those three issues were always like the central of what I was writing, and I'm accepting that like that's who I am. That's who I identify as a writer.
That's cool. That's cool. I know a lot of poets put together chapbooks just sort of, you know, here are the 12 to 20 most recent poems that I'm proud of kind of way. So I always appreciate the idea of a strong concept project and, you know, the exploration you can do in just one particular subject. We mm-hmm. are coming down on the end of our show. So first off, I wanted to thank you for being such an awesome guest.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. We're going to have you read us out in a second. For those of us listening, I'm Rick McIntyre filling in for Susan Dobie Chase. This has been Spoken Heard. And our guest next week is Gabriel De Los Reyes. And, Mark, if you could read us out.
Okay. This one's called My Polish Ancestor Replies. I don't have the answers. You only seek me when it's convenient, when you are digging for something that needs an ethnic flair, when you're reaching for something to say to a familiar face who knows you lost the connection to home before you were born, about which conquerors have stripped our name, the centuries of identity crisis, or why your family ran towards a dream. There is two times a year that you claim to be one of us, sit at our table, eat my food, told stories about how the holidays are supposed to be, about the church you will never visit, and the language that was misplaced in assimilation. Wipe that dumb look from your face when you're trying to hear my voice and other Slavic's words. You don't know the difference between me and someone else. Maybe your answers are in things you don't understand. Open up and listen. Thank you.
And thank you, Mark. Again, Mark Stripchak, our guest this week. For those of you out in poetry land, be good to each other. We're all going to need support.